Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week we bask in the glow of awards season. Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps and myself will be summing up the glittering London Critics Circle Awards, where we met an array of British and international talent, including Colin Firth and Quentin Tarantino. Zan Brooks and I will glance back at the BAFTAs and review some of the week's releases, including Timothy Oliphant in The Crazies, Jean-Pierre Jeunet's outlandish Micmacs, and Michael Moore and his latest polemic, Capitalism, A Love Story. Also on the show this week, a young British actor turns all-American zombie. We'll be asking Joe Anderson how he ended up in The Crazies. Yes, it's better than a brief acceptance speech. It's Film Weekly.
You're just bombarded with distractions, so you don't really have much time to agonise and play games with your mind about whatever hopes or childhood hopes or anything life beyond, really.
Well, it seems everyone gets a little bit flustered in award season. Colin Firth, no exception there, as he was accepting his Best British Actor Award at this year's London Critics Circle Awards, which took place at the Landmark Hotel here in London, of course, last week. In the interests of transparency, I must declare that I am the chairman of the London Critics Circle, so the annual awards ceremony was my time of year for putting the black tie on, the microphone down, and hosting and glad handing all the celebs. I'm joined by Film Weekly's producer, Jason Phipps, who took on recording duties for the evening. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you, Jason.
Nice to see you. Thank you so much for going down there. How was it backstage from Hack's perspective?
My pleasure. I have to say, you know that the mosh pit, as we call it, in award ceremonies where you have to catch people on the red carpet, then you go back for the awards and it's all very sort of industrial.
Yeah.
It was actually really good. This year I had a really good time backstage. It was very clear that everyone was having a good time, so congratulations.
Thank you very much indeed. No, I know we kept looking at the BAFTAs as well. I mean, our ceremony was really good fun, actually. Everyone seemed to be enjoying themselves, and there was a good spirit in the room. I was very, very delighted with the whole thing. We had a huge guest, of course, as well, not just Vittorio Storaro, the cinematographer of Apocalypse Now, who came along
and ambassador for world peace.
Wasn't he? Just, I don't know what he was going on about, to be honest with you, but it was great to have him there with the big white scarf and his lecture on the good and evil. But Quentin Tarantino was there getting the Dillis Powell Award. Now, I had a lot of kind of people saying, oh, the Dillis Powell Award, that's for kind of illustrious kind of old people, kind of the greats of British cinema. But I've sort of been, you know, we've awarded the greats of British cinema, and I wanted to give it to someone who was going forward for the future.
Well, I think that, as is usual, Quentin Tarantino, of course, knew who Dillis Powell is and was pretty expert, very gracious in accepting the award, and very aware of all the things that you pointed out there. This is what he had to say on it.
It's pretty gratifying because, one, I'm a big fan of Dillis Powell. I think she's really terrific. So it's really, I'm a big fan of film criticism. Not necessarily other people who practice it, but the idea of film criticism. If I wasn't a filmmaker, I'd be a film critic, but the only thing I'd be qualified to do. And since I like Dillis Powell's work so much, it's just wonderful to get an award in her name. I hadn't realized who the past recipients were. So it wasn't until I was at the ceremony and I was reading the past recipients, and it was, you know, John Mills and Richard Harris, and I was like, fuck me, I am like way too young to get this award. But I actually really like that. I actually like the idea of getting, because I think this is hands down, this is the middle of my career. And I actually like the idea of giving an award to somebody in the middle where you still think their best work might be in front of them as an encouragement.
Oh, well, that's good. Quentin was on message. He knew what it was.
I didn't tell him all that.
But when I called him to offer him the award, he'd actually was diving into two volumes of Dillis Powell's film criticism. I mean, no one else does that. That's brilliant. No,
what's his bedside reading look like? I mean, you can imagine the books on his sideboard. Yeah.
did he sort of give any hint to like future gossip? What's going on? Is he working?
Yeah, he spoke a little bit. Well, I tell you what, he didn't give anything away. What he did was, in an answer to a question about a third Kill Bill film, he said, well, he hadn't killed the Daryl Hannah character off, and that he quite liked the idea of a now blind assassin taking her revenge.
As a female twitchy figure.
And it's been noted that Daryl Hannah has said she'd love to do another film.
I'm sure she would.
Yeah. But and Uma Thurman, it's a career-defining character for her, so I'm sure that she'd like to get back into that yellow and black suit.
Yeah, I'd like to get back into that yellow suit. Quentin, it's interesting when you fly Quentin in and he sits there and he kind of goes through all these kind of British actors and Fish Tank, which won four awards. You hope that that you're kind of setting something in front of him that's kind of interesting, and you know that you're welcoming me into a British ceremony that is, you know, not going to be embarrassing.
He was very engaged in what was going on, and he had something I think very insightful and very complimentary to say about the British film industry.
I would actually have to say that, I mean, when I first came here in 92 at Reservoir Dogs, the film industry in England was very dire. It was very, very, you guys didn't even have a fucking film industry, for lack of a better word. You know, and the movies were Enchanted April and crap like that. But that has changed. And this year, more than most, really highlighted how it's changed with the fact that when you had the best British films, there were like five really good movies, and there was a couple other movies that could have even made that list, and they weren't on there. So that is fantastic. You guys actually have a genuine, honest to goodness, bona fide film industry again, and that is fantastic.
Oh, well, that's good, because when he was chairman of the jury in Cannes, I remember going to a press conference as well, and he was saying, well, the problem with the British film industry is that we don't have any stars, we don't have a star system, and it is something that people are working on now. I know that executives, because I did this piece kind of lambasting a bit the state of the British industry a bit, just giving it a little bit of a chiv along a few months ago, and a lot of people have kind of responded and said, yes, let's talk about star systems. And I suppose that we do have some stars here, and Colin Firth, I think, is just sort of suddenly, with A Single Man, becoming a star. I think he's been a big figure, everyone knows his name, but I think that this Tom Ford film has really made him into a star, winning awards all over the place.
And in a sort of British actor's set piece, because you've got Matthew Good and the brilliant Nicholas Hoult in that film as well. It's a tour de force for British acting. And Colin Firth, of course, came away with the Best British Actor Award and went on to do very well at the BAFTAs, thanks to his kitchen repairman, as we all heard. But this is what he had to say about being the kind of great British hope for the Oscars.
Oh, I like this, because this is, you know, we do get the it's like Olympic swimmers. Go Colin, go Colin.
The British have a way of rooting for you in a way that's rather conditional. And but that is an absolutely uncomplicated joy, to feel people rooting for you. But at the same time, it's not a sport or a national sport. I do think that, particularly with the business of storytelling, and certainly what I do, is about crossing those boundaries wherever possible. You know, I don't, despite what people have asked me to do so often, I don't believe my job is only to play people of one particular nationality. So I don't see it exclusively in those terms, but there is something rather irresistible about, however contradictory this is, feeling that you're playing for the national team, yeah.
And he won't be alone, I suppose, on Oscar night as well, because we'll be cheering Kerry Mulligan as
well.
Yeah,
she was also very humble. She's clearly just trying to get her head around the idea that her career has gone stellar. She made some very interesting remarks about the fact that every award means that she literally gets into the room to discuss parts that she'd like to do, and that's very hard, no matter who you are in the acting.
She's only little,
fraternity.
You know, she's only 24. And yeah, I think she said when she accepted her speech, she said, this is really nice from the critics. I've always wanted to be. I had dinner with her in Los Angeles, dropping a name, about 2 years ago. And she's like, I just want to be in films that you criticise, that you mention in your column that you have in the show. And sort of suddenly, you know, she's always been in little bit parts in films. She'd been in Pride and Prejudice, but no one mentioned, oh, a nice appearance from Kerry Mulligan. But now it's like all about Kerry Mulligan.
She just literally flew in from shooting Oliver Stone's next Wall Street film.
Did you see Michael Fassbender? He won Supporting Actor.
I'll tell you what, I had the first occasion of what I would call Paddy to Paddy starstruckdom, which is because he is a Paddy. And he has a fine Irish accent. I'm usually not fazed when it comes to Irish people. I'll just say hello and everything. But you kindly introduced me to Mr. Fassbender, and I was starstruck. I really didn't want to say anything glib to him. I didn't want to say anything that was trite.
I think he doesn't suffer fools particularly gladly.
No, he
doesn't really need to be glad. But he's a handsome man. Maybe it was that stare that got you, those cheekbones.
You know, it was the stare. He looked up. He's not quite as tall as I would have expected him. He's probably of our stature, Jason.
Yeah, I know it's unusual because actors are quite... Colin Firth, for example, is tall. I'll tell you who isn't tall. It's Christoph Waltz. He's nice and small.
He is. He's, but great things come in small sizes.
They
don't
do.
They?
He has become the star of the show. I mean, obviously, he won at the BAFTAs. I think he's an absolute, you know, gold certainty. Close all the bets now for the Oscars as well. But I was really pleased because at the London Critics, he won Best Actor, not supporting, just actor. So, you know, for his role as Hans Landa, which is kind of a dominating role, but it must have been some kind of irony to come here and accept awards. Because, I mean, I'd never seen him before this film.
Well, he told a story, a personal anecdote as he accepted the award, which I was clearly surprised about, where he said getting this award in London came as a particular sweet surprise, and this is what he had to say.
This whole London thing has made me a little nervous because I used to live here for almost 20 years and I desperately tried to get jobs and never did, so I had to go back to where they speak German to work and make a living. So London Critics giving me this, you know, now. It's not never too late. Thank you.
I mean, I remember sort of in Cannes, people said, oh, yeah, I think he was trying to be in soap operas and things like this. I'd never seen him before.
He must be in The Bill somewhere then. There must be an episode of The Bill with Christoph Waltz.
We're going to find that. Or maybe he's Casualty. Maybe he's the one with that Kate Winslet episode in Casualty. Maybe he's serving dessert to her.
He's somewhere in the background mopping floors.
Exactly. Jason Phipps, thank you for capturing all that flavour of the London Critics Circle Awards. If you want to see a full list of winners, go to criticscircle.org.uk/film, and there you can see we gave Best Film to a foreign film. The BAFTAs and the Oscars would never do that, would they? Zan Brooks joins me now. You were at the BAFTAs, Zan. Where were you? I've read your live blog.
I was up in the gods, basically, but not even in the gods. I was in a kind of converted dance studio, which gave it a slightly odd air.
This is where fame costs, and this is where you start paying.
Yeah, in sweat. Yeah. And I paid in sweat, hunched in front of a TV with my laptop.
Oh, that's
so. It wasn't
were.
Quite like being there.
It wasn't quite
though,
the glamour.
Even though you kind of ran into people.
I was
corridors.
Nice and high and
were you now?
Sitting within the golden heavens of the Opera House. I do like it, the Opera House.
Yes, yeah, I had Terry Gilliam hold the door open for me when I left, which I felt was my
just
one
as
brush
be.
With stardom.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I read your blog sort of in retrospect, not live, which is kind of a strange thing to do, but it worked very well. It's funny, you have to take a stance whilst I am here doing this, yet it is all clearly nonsense.
Yeah, but isn't that the case of most of the things that we do? We mustn't look at it too closely because it tatters and fades.
Was it a good BAFTAs or a bad BAFTAs?
I think it probably was a good BAFTAs. I think it was a good corrective to the Golden Globes, which seemed to give Avatar everything. Mm. On this occasion, the Hurt Locker seemed to get the lion's share. And because I think The Hurt Locker is a better film than Avatar, it was a good result.
Seemed right to me.
I think so.
I thought the BAFTAs itself was blimmin' boring, though.
Yeah, it was.
Really
it was
boring.
It was
I felt like
tedious.
I was 10 again watching it at home going, God, this is boring.
It really was.
But it was spectacularly so. It hasn't been that boring for years and years and years.
Maybe not. I thought Jonathan Ross as the host was very pallid and nervous and muted. I guess maybe sort of past troubles means that he's basically got a kind of gagging order on him.
Literally. I mean, there were no gags.
No gags at all.
Zan, let's get into this week's reviews. We'll look at Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story. Then we'll look at Jean-Pierre Jeunet's Micmacs Attire Larigot, to give it its full French title, though no one knows what that means. And then we'll look at The Crazies, if you will. So let's start with Michael Moore. Zan, this was in Venice, and it now arrives on our shores. A look at the way that capitalism has failed as an economic system and put us all in the soup.
The media focused on the actions of the pilots.
Captain Marvin Renslow and First Officer Shaw were chatting about their careers.
Careers is a euphemism for what the pilots were really talking about, how little they were paid and how overworked they were. There would be no discussion in the media about why we have an economic system that allows a pilot to be paid less than a manager at Taco Bell.
First Officer Shaw made between $16,000 and $20,000 a year and at one point worked a second job.
Her second job had been waitressing at a coffee shop. How are these companies able to get away with this? I guess that's the point of capitalism. It allows you to get away with anything.
There's Michael Moore looking at the crazy upside-down world where a man from the fast food restaurant gets more than a pilot, putting us all in jeopardy of some kind. That was a strange example, I thought, to use for capitalism that it happened. But he does this all throughout, the kind of the strange way that things just aren't seem to working, that things don't make sense. I really liked this sort of Michael Moore lesson.
I did. I mean, you say that it's about how capitalism has put us all in the soup, but maybe not quite all. There's a leaked Citibank report at the heart of this film that says that America is now a plutonomy in which 1% of the population control 95% of the wealth.
Yeah, no, I'm assuming that them aren't listening to this.
I don't know, do you think?
Maybe some of them are. Yes, you're right, that there are a very, 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 very large few. Number of wealthy people, but there is a huge number of people who are sort of panicking in their wake. And I suppose it was ever thus the film draws attention to the fact that just in the crash, it's now coming to light, really.
Yeah, you're right. And the crash and the subsequent $700 billion bailout of public money gives this film the perfect peg. And also suggests this wonderful double standards by the ruling class, where they're all for free enterprise until it's not working for them, and then they want a handout.
I liked Michael Moore here. I don't think he tries to make sort of too much comic kind of potential out of it. I think he's genuinely angry and perplexed. I mean, he's very good at playing that figure. But I think there is a genuine kind of head scratch as to how on earth we've got into this mess.
I think so. I think there's a sort of righteous anger at the heart of this film that made it, for me, utterly compelling. Mm. And engrossing. And there's also a great human element to this. He does very well in ferreting out the human stories to illustrate the wider crime that he's spotlighting here. Whether that be the sheriff who refuses to evict people from their homes because he reasons that if we've just given the bank this amount of money, then it befalls to them to pass some of that down, maybe, to other people who are in need. And that anchors the film, I think. Also, the great thing about him, and obviously it's the thing that also gets up people's noses, is his populist stance. He's basically the liberal Rush Limbaugh, with all that entails. So he can be crude, he can be sentimental, he's wildly a propagandist here. And here he does make this very interesting and, I think, telling argument, that basically it's not the kind of wishy-washy liberal argument of like, oh, let's all try and be nice to each other. He is basically using the right-wing argument and turning it on its head and saying that capitalism is actually un-Christian and un-American. There's a great bit where he actually goes and looks at the Constitution and says there's no reference to capitalism here, and actually in its essence this sounds more like socialism.
Yes, absolutely. That's a very, very effective bit as well. Capitalism, a love story with heavy irony. We shall leave Michael Moore. Let's go to Jean-Pierre Jeunet now, Zan. He is the man, of course, who burst onto the international mainstream in 1991 with Delicatessen and then The City of Lost Children. Then he went to Hollywood, of course, to do a sort of failed Aliens 4, The Resurrection, and came back much intact to give us Amélie, or The Fabulous Destiny of Amélie Poulain. He now gives us Micmac, the story of Basil, a shrapnel victim who vows to take inventive revenge on two arms dealers and their munitions depots with the help of some funny new friends.
Le compas dans l'œil, l'estomac dans les talons, il tient la base haute, se met martel en tête et passe du coq à l'âne. Oui, le compas dans l'œil, à noter.
Il était ethnographe à Brazzaville.
Ooh, qu'est-ce que c'est que Madcap, Zan? Ooh, c'est très funny, non?
Non. absolument non. And that's as far as my French goes.
Yeah, three times non.
Three times non. I didn't like Amélie, and I don't really like this, and I guess that means I don't really like Jeunet.
Yeah, it must be. Delicatessen?
Delicatessen, I think, had a wonderful novelty value to it, and I remember seeing that when it came out and thinking, it looks great. Yeah. And they always look great. He is a wonderful, ingenious visual director. But that's as far as it goes for me. And I find his sort of whimsical air a little bit grating.
So Basil here, played by Danny Boone, who is, of course, France's great comic hero now. He's the star of Bienvenue chez les Ch'tis, the highest grossing film in French history now. Yeah. Is he a comic genius?
Not on this evidence, I don't think. But, you know, what we have to acknowledge when we're discussing a film like this is that maybe there's this terrible cultural divide that we can't quite get over. In theory, we love things to be purely French, or that's so wonderfully French. Mm. But when it's a comedy, I think that traditionally we have slight problems with that.
Well, it just doesn't, comedy just doesn't travel very well. I mean, Bienvenue Shelley Steed didn't travel particularly well here. It's being remade in Hollywood. Most of those French comedies don't work here. But Journey has in the past. I mean, Long Engagement, Amelie, they have been very successful here.
They have. I don't think this works as well, possibly because it's trying for more. It's trying to be a political satire.
I think that's the problem, isn't it?
And that is the problem. It is about landmines and war crimes and all of that. But in the guise of this whimsical, sentimental, romantic flight
this
of fancy.
Kind of comic book human cannonballs and kind of all sorts of hobbledehoy characters who are contortionists and circus people, and they live in this garbage shit. They're like wombles or something.
They are like wombles,
and they open the fridge and there's a woman in there where they're kind of handing you some milk.
And a lot of Heath Robinson kind of cogs and pulleys and all of that.
I couldn't bear it. I really wanted to hit my head on with a very sharp implement to
blow yourself
away.
Up with
really
a landmine.
It would have been amusing.
I think, but maybe that is something that we struggle to match that sort of form and content with. I think if we want a political satire, we like it to be dry and biting and angry, not soft and gentle and all about the wonder of the imagination.
Yeah, I've got a feeling that I don't know how this is done in France. My feeling is not particularly well, because it's not sort of mentioned at the César up and coming.
Yeah, maybe not.
Perhaps I think it was just a bad idea, not very well put together. But I mean, it looks like it cost a fortune.
It does, yeah, it does. And it looks great. I mean, as we've said before, there's he harks back to a very noble tradition of French cinema that goes back through, say, Jacques Tati. Yeah. Back to Georges Méliès, and it is...
Man on telly.
Georges Méliès, the man on telly, exactly.
The guy who said the thing
I do
to the
mean
moon,
the
Méliès.
Guy, I don't mean Roger Méliès.
No. Okay. Or Georges Méliès, the jazzer.
No.
In residence.
No. I'm assuming a certain amount of film knowledge here.
Okay. Just in case there's 1% of the plutocratic Americans aren't tuning in this week, I just thought I'd...
And thinking I didn't know that Georges Méliès made a film about the moon.
Yes.
He didn't.
I think we should stop kicking poor Jean-Pierre Jeunet while he's down, actually, because it's a bit of a shame for him. Should we turn to the crazies.
Let's turn to the crazies. The crazies are good.
We think the crazies are good. They are taking over the town of Ogden Marsh, which all seems well. The Tigers baseball team are going very well indeed. And then one of the town drunks ends up on the football field raising a gun. So Sheriff Timothy Oliphant has to gun him down. Then he goes out into the swamp with some rednecks and finds that a plane has been leaking something nasty into the water.
A plane that size goes down, nothing in the paper, nothing in the news. Make any sense to you?
It depends on what the payload is.
Exactly what I'm thinking.
Which is what?
Hopman Bog. What's that drain into?
Dwyer Creek.
Which drains into?
Black Pond. Oh, hey, you remember that monster catfish?
Russell, where do you think we get our drinking water from?
Timothy Oliphant, we had him on this show because we just think he's very good. We saw him in A Perfect Getaway. He's very good at these sort of B-movie things, and this is really a B-movie running riot, isn't it?
Yeah, and he was great in Deadwood as well. That's what I know him best from. And he's perfectly cast in this modern-day B-movie, which is a remake of the George Romero 1973 film that I have to confess I have not seen.
Me neither. Brilliant. I haven't seen it. I suspect, however, that George Romero's 1973 film had some kind of toothy satire about consumerism.
Well, that's a zombie film for you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This one, what I like about this one is it doesn't really have that.
It doesn't.
Sort of suggests that the news media is a bit untrustworthy.
Well, and the military are untrustworthy.
Yes, well, obviously. They are.
But that's par for the course of any kind of zombie film. And here, it's not in big bold letters. It's very much a little subtext.
So where do its thrills come? Why did this work? I mean, I wasn't looking forward to it at all, but I actually really enjoyed myself.
I really enjoyed this in the first half, and then I thought it got a bit generic. In the first half, when the tension is mounting in this sleepy little Iowa farming community, when there's the idyllic baseball game going on and the guy shambles onto the pitch with a shotgun, when people just start acting a little bit strange, and Radha Mitchell is the doctor trying to treat some of them and not quite being aware of what's going on. She's great, isn't she? Then it had this wonderful build of tension and the great mix of total Americana normalcy with oddness. And it's that William Carlos Williams poem, isn't it? That the pure products of America go crazy.
Exactly.
And that's always a guaranteed thrill.
So when
I think,
a farmer sort of for no reason starts his combine harvester up in the middle of the night and goes to the barn, it's those kind of American gothic
it's those
moments.
Little transgressions that hint at a world sort of slipping off its axis. And that was was great. Inevitably, then it becomes about monsters running around and lots of makeup and blood. And then it becomes a bit more, we've seen this before and we should see it again.
Yeah, but you get to play the game, like which one of the infected actually is, isn't infected, and then which one is, and they might kind of bite you, and you know, you'll watch them. It's kind of, you know, Danny Boyle did it in 28 Days Later. Mm. People have been doing it for years and years. But it kind of worked, I thought, very effectively. I like Timothy Oliphant and Roderick Mitchell. They're both actors who get to go through ordeals in all their films. It seems
and they're believable people. Mm. You can almost imagine knowing them a bit. And so because of that, you really feel for them when they're up against it, as they continually are here.
Yeah, and I thought it was shot rather nicely as well. And there was a sort of strain of humour going on as well, as there needs to be.
Well, it's certainly better than Breck Eisner's last film, which was Sahara, which was notoriously one of the big flops of a couple of years ago.
That was the one with the...
with Penelope Cruz and Matthew
Steve
McConaughey.
Zahn in the desert.
Yeah.
As the bad film.
So there are second acts in American lives, I guess, particularly if your dad is Michael Eisner, then you get to make another movie.
Dan, all that live blogging from the BAFTAs has imbued you with a cynicism that I fear may never
like
wash off.
I don't like the plutocrats. I've watched Michael Moore. I don't like the top 1%.
Right. Well, will you give it to them at the Oscars?
Yes,
good.
I will.
Nice and straight. Zan, lovely to see you. Zan Brooks, you can read his live blog still, I suppose.
Like a zombie.
It lives on like a zombie. It's still on the world's finest film site, guardian.co.uk/film. As you heard, they're one of the strength of the zombie film The Crazies is the casting, particularly Timothy Oliphant as the town sheriff and Radha Mitchell as his wife. But I kept looking at the screen going, who's that deputy? I know him. It was really bugging me. Turns out he was played by a British actor called Joe Anderson. You couldn't tell. His hick deputy's accent was absolutely perfect. And I knew where I'd seen him from when I IMDb'd him straight afterwards. He played Peter Hook, or Hooky, in Anton Corbijn's superb film Control. He also played Henry Austin in Becoming Jane, and he's also been in films like Mira Nair's Amelia alongside Hilary Swank. He's now given a very strong performance in The Crazies and is shooting a film up in Newcastle as we speak. Keen as ever to trace the rise of a young British star and mark him out for the future here on Film Weekly, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Joe Anderson now. Where are you?
I'm currently in Newcastle upon Tyne, sunny Newcastle.
What are you doing there?
I'm shooting a film called Flutter, a movie about gambling, really, dog racing. And I play a character called John, who sort of ends up really sort of selling his soul to this whole idea of gambling. There was a certain point in the script that involved my character growing an ear on him for a bet. For a certain amount of money, and that was one of the things that really sort of drew me to this movie, was, you know, that we can actually get there in such a surreal manner, and for it not to feel contrived or sort of put there just for an effect, really.
It sounds worth a punt, I've got to say. The reason we're talking to you today is because The Crazies is out this week as well. And I'm wondering why I'm asking what you're doing in Newcastle, because I was watching The Crazies, Joe, and I was thinking, well, I love Timothy Oliphant, I like Radha Mitchell, I know them. And then I know this guy, this deputy guy, this American acting deputy guy. I know him. Where do I know him from? It bugged me the entire movie. And then it came up, Joe Anderson. I thought, nah, I'm not getting it. I'll get home. And I'm like, oh, but yeah, he was Peter Hook in Control. So how do you go, like, from Peter Hooky in Control, and then you're playing, I mean, a seamless hick, if I may say so, in Ogden Marsh, the town where The Crazies is set.
It's a bit of a big transition, really. I think really one of the things that attracts me to this business is the opportunity to be somebody else and to be something that is very far away from who I am as a human being. So looking at roles, you know, Peter Hook is obviously somebody who couldn't be further from me in terms of where he's from, what he's done, attitudes and personality, and that for me as an actor to chew on that idea of a character is just far more juicy than doing something that is closer to myself. And it's for me as well, you know, I was raised watching American movies. You know, I went to the cinema every week as a kid, and I was never a big academic. I was never a big reader. So really, it's quite comforting in a way to be able to do these characters that, that sort of hark back to memories of movies when I was a kid and what I would have watched.
So, yeah. So who were you thinking of when you were playing? Because this is a nice little B movie, this The Crazies. I really enjoyed it. So what were you thinking of? What were you channeling? What was the memories coming back to you as a kind of recall as an actor?
There were many sort of moments of Sean Penn in a weird way in Dead Man Walking in terms of sort of attitudes and timbre within the voice. But actually, my wife's brother-in-law really was the skeleton which I hung the character on. He's a sort of deep Southern Virginian guy, and obviously I just through talking to him just thought that it was he had a wonderful sort of tone and manner.
It's very handy, isn't it?
Yeah,
that she was married. Lucky so she wasn't nice. Married to someone from Liverpool. He would never have got the part.
Bit tricky to do it if you're basing it on somebody from Liverpool.
but it was. I mean, it's great for what I mean for a young British actor to do the accent right. It's very crucial. You know what I mean? Something like Tom Wilkinson. No one had heard of him. He did Full Monty. Then they found out he could do a great American accent. The guy's never stopped working.
Well, I mean, initially it was always my intention to sort of go over to the States and start working over there. Because obviously it's the hub of cinema, really, for the Western world, and I was very sort of conscious of not wanting to be the English actor who's come to America, and trying to work from the inside out, and you know, work my way up, playing roles in various different accents, and keeping that sort of versatility, you know, so that I hopefully don't get pigeonholed into one thing, which can happen quite easily.
Then I looked and I saw you were in the film The Ruins, a film I really enjoyed. Again, another sort of B-movie, creepy kind of monster Ivy movie. And you were the German student in that, weren't you? He was like a backpacker.
Again, it was another opportunity. The book was obviously something that of The Ruins that I knew. Just the idea of killer vines, I was just so intrigued as to how they were going to do that and pull that off without it sort of looking like Little Shop of Horrors on speed.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, just on that premise alone, I was just intrigued. And then when they asked about the German character, of course, being a European, I know a few Germans, it ended up a little bit of a Peter Sellers German accent at the beginning, and you know, we managed to sort of bring it down to the 21st century.
Yeah, you got away with it very nicely. There's obviously a few roles I'm running through, because our listeners may, like me, know who you are but couldn't quite place you. But I got to ask you about working with Timothy Oliphant. We had him on the show not long ago simply because we thought he was very good and we wanted to talk to him. Did you talk to him about this? Because he also is a character actor as well, a man that a lot of people might say, oh, I've seen him. I don't know quite where, but then you mass suddenly a body of work, and the guy's a terrific actor and playing your boss in the movie. I mean, he's a real kind of shining example of how to kind of manage a career, isn't he?
Yeah, Tim's he's a great actor. He's one of those actors that can work on many different levels, a purely instinctual, guttural level, a very technical, to the beat level. He really knows a film set. He really knows his cameras and what's going on. And also, he's very helpful. I mean, he was always sort of helping me out in terms of just giving little ideas and little things to do. And it's so sweet when somebody is doing that for you, because you feel like you're being supported, and therefore you can play and take risks without too much fear.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed the playing between the two of you. I really enjoyed The Crazies, so congratulations on that. I'm just glad we could get hold of you. Just wanted to say well done. Keep going. We wanted to be one of the first to kind of say Joe Anderson. You heard him here first on Film Weekly. Good luck with Flutter. Get those words right from my friend Stephen Leslie on his script, and you're going to be great in that, and we look forward to having you back on when you're above the line starring Joe Anderson.
Thank you very much, Jason. Good speaking to you. Take care, mate.
Cheers. Thanks to Joe Anderson there. Remember, you heard him on Film Weekly first. Indeed, thanks to all our guests on today's show. Do pick up the new handsomely redesigned Observer review. This Sunday's paper will contain my trailer trash column, of course, and an interview with Kristen Stewart, Orange Rising Star BAFTA winner. And the music featured in this week's show is taken from the score to Micmac by Raphael Lebeau. But from the two Jasons here at Guardian Studios, it's goodbye and see you next week.